Baseball is back, and so is MLB.tv. Watch every out-of-market, regular season game on your favorite streaming devices. Anywhere, anytime, all season long. Follow the action live or on demand. Track four games at once with multi-view mode. And catch up with in-game highlights. Plus, original programs, minor league broadcasts, and local pre- and post-game shows. Go to MLB.tv to start your free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
In a ripcord-like pull of ending the fun here for just a second, Ray. And that was a great conversation. We thanked him very, very much for joining us. It really is an interesting article. I read another article today that is interesting, not fun at all. And we're about to, in our next segment, Ray, get into the stuff that you want to talk about and have a little fun there. This is not fun, but we need to talk about it because it's what we do. There's a story coming from Ann Arbor that is not only shocking because of what it is on the surface, but the detail of an own's son's cry for help looking like that they were ignored. And whom to believe, who to believe in this story is still murky. But when you start adding accusations up, it's not out of the realm of possibility. Two former Michigan football players say that they believe that they could have been spared from sexual assaults if their coach, Bo Schembechler, had addressed complaints about a former team doctor named Robert Anderson. Not only are they accusing Bo of ignoring them, but apparently a complaint was also made by Schembechler's own adopted son that he had been sexually abused by the same doctor. And Bo Schembechler, apparently, when he told his stepdad what happened at this doctor's appointment that he went to as a 10-year-old boy, he told the kid that he didn't want to hear it. He beat his wife, according to Matt Schembechler's account of what happened, and that pretty much severed a lifetime of any happiness between stepson and stepfather right there. And there have been odds over the Schembechler legacy in the Schembechler family between his natural born children, his adopted children through marriage, if you will. It's as ugly as a story can be, Ray.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and I don't want to play geographical, you know, games here, but it does seem to be sort of prevalent in that part of the country with colleges that, frankly, the impulse is, I don't want to hear it, and if I don't have to hear it, it doesn't exist. I know that Matt Schembechler's brother, Glenn, who is 10 years younger, says he doesn't believe the story, but I don't know what the benefit would be to come out now with it, which suggests to me that Bo Schembechler was like a lot of people from that generation who knew that such things existed, but neither were able to do anything about it because they didn't understand it, or they didn't want to do anything about it because it was uncomfortable and complicated. And in either event, Bo Schembechler comes off very poorly here.
Yeah.
And I will be interested to see if University of Michigan alums from that generation defend him with the same zeal that Penn State alums have come to defend Joe Paterno as, this guy was my idol. He couldn't have possibly been this guy. When I think we know that a lot of people could have been that guy and were that guy from time to back then. I think people are more aware of problems like this now because there are more avenues in which to report it. But when your only avenue was a parent who didn't believe you, the years of damage from that, even no matter what the circumstances, are incalculable. And if it is true, it's inexcusable. And, you know, then Bo Schembechler's statues should come down in Ann Arbor just as much as Paterno statues came down in State College, because there's no good explanation for ignoring that.
Dr. Robert Anderson, the man who Schembechler has posthumously accused of molesting him, served in a variety of roles at Michigan between the years of 1966 and 2003. More than 800 former patients have made legal claims that Anderson sexually assaulted them during physical exams and other routine medical appointments. 800. That is an awful lot more than the 30 or 40 athletes and Michigan State gymnasts that came forward in that well-publicized and documented doctor sexual assault case that rippled through USA Gymnastics and is still doing so leading up to the Olympics. Dr. Larry Nassar, if you will, that was that guy's name. This Dr. Robert Anderson seems to be certainly through an overwhelming amount of complaints appear to be guilty as sin. He has died, so there's really nothing that can be done. And, you know, you can't help but say, well, you know, college football, legendary coach, and link Joe Paterno to this. The element in our entire lives, Ray, at least I don't want to speak for you. In my entire life, I don't think, and I certainly hope I don't, ever cover a story from the world of sports that was more horrific than little boys being molested in Penn State shower. That is the low point of my entire sports broadcasting career, I would hope, in terms of I cannot believe that this was allowed to happen.
Well,
the element of ignoring your own son's pleas and reporting of what just happened to you is a level that I can't even comprehend now that I'm a father myself, Ray. I do not understand how any amount of winning percentage or go big blue, we got a game in the big house, would take your eye or ear off your own, well, in his case, adopted child, but still very much your own child, telling you, Dad, I just got sexually molested by your team doctor. Should we talk?
But I think you have the hideous answer to that already. We found out what the winning percentage is that would allow that to happen.
We did.
If this story is true, and I have no reason to believe it isn't, you've already got the answer. Winning basically control, you know, overrules everything. In fact, I'll give you the most disturbing paragraph in the whole story. One of the two ex-players said he recalled assistant coaches telling players that if they didn't work hard, they would have to go have a visit with Dr. Anderson. And the quote from the player is, "Only now do I realize how crazy it was to threaten rape as a way of motivating players to work harder." That's frightening, because now it takes it from, I don't want to hear my own son, but I'm okay with using that as some sort of sick motivational tool that, you know, I mean, that's beyond the pale.
Yeah.
I mean, it's to call it horrifying isn't doing it justice. I mean, if that's the framework in which, you know, that program operated, shame on them for every win he ever got for him. Shame on them for every dollar that school ever took in because of that football program. It's all dirty money, and they're all dirty victories.
Oh, it's really, really something else. So it's as uncomfortable a story as you can absolutely put out there, and we will know more about it, but we had to let you know that it happened this week, and I guess it's something to keep an eye on. And boy, if something is happening to you, if something has happened to you, report it to the authorities, because people are listening and looking at these issues now with more scrutiny than ever before. And that is the only good thing coming out of all this. Damon Ratto and Kolsky on 95.7 The Game. We are going to get back to the fun Friday show that we were just having. I can promise you that. And the master of ceremonies of fun should always be Ray Ratto. Let's come on back finding out what Ray wants to talk about. That's next here on Damon Ratto and Kolsky, 95.7 The Game.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.
Damon, Ratto, and Kolsky continues on 95.7 The Game.
We'll find out in just a little bit, but first, a couple of things to let you know about. It's a chance for you to win $1,000 right here, right now. Text the code word BEAM to 72881, B-E-A-M to 72881. A chance to win $1,000 brought to you by your local Toyota dealers. Toyota, let's go places. A multi-state contest with message and data rates applying indeed. We will get to the things that Ray Ratto wants to talk about in about 12, 15 minutes from right now. But right now, we get to talk about the things that Amin El-Hassan wants to talk about. And I certainly hope that he also wants to talk about the fact that he is now with Meadowlark Media, which is like one of the coolest named new companies on the block. Obviously, you, Dan Lebatard, that whole crew just did what, a free dumb 24-hour podcast. Did you get a nap in between then and your appearance here today, Amin?
Yes. I at the conclusion of the 24-hour event, you know, I was awake at 7 a.m. on Friday. The event started at noon. We got done Saturday at noon. I was awake that whole time. I actually went out to brunch afterwards. I knocked back a couple, got back to my hotel room at around 3:30. And from 3:30 in the afternoon on Saturday until 7 a.m. on Sunday, I was asleep.
There you go. A nap in the middle of the day is not walking through that door. He's just going to sleep the entire day. Thank you very much.
A mere nap. Yes, a mere nap to walk through that door.
That's a segue to the Nuggets, right?
Sure. Why not? Because they're about to go home.
And they've been sleeping their way through so far. The NBA, you know, sort of made its first stop in Milwaukee last night, and it was essentially a pie fight. And what I wanted to ask about is not so much whether Milwaukee can ugly up this series and extend it beyond what looks like five games, but whether Milwaukee understands what to do with Giannis Antetokounmpo or whether Giannis understands what to do with Giannis Antetokounmpo, because it seemed like last night was a particularly egregious example of him basically believing he needs to end every possession with a shot no matter where he is on the floor. And I kind of wonder whether that's Mike Budenholzer's fault or that's Giannis's fault, because it's not a very efficient way to use one of the best players in basketball.
You know, if I said that mirrored my thoughts, I probably wouldn't be, that wouldn't be strong enough of an agreement. I compared it earlier today on the radio to the 2000, early 2000s Lakers. You say Shaq and Kobe, and you ask who was the best player on that team. I think we all would say Shaq was the best player on the team. But at the end of the game, when possessions are on the line, who had the ball in his hand? It was Kobe. Is it because Kobe was secretly better? No, I don't believe that. It's because Kobe was better equipped in those moments to have the ball in his hands. Now, sometimes the ball would find its way to Shaq. He got great post position, and, you know, he's got a mismatch, or, you know, pretty much anybody with a mismatch. He caught it right near in his sweet spot, in his power zone, and he did his thing. We never threw the ball to Shaq 23 feet away from the basket and said, "You're our best player, big fella. Now go win us the game." For some ungodly reason, Milwaukee, for 3 years now, this isn't a new thing, for three straight years, have been stuck with this belief somehow that because Giannis is our best player, that means we give him the ball, and then he's ipso facto, he's going to win us the game because he's great and he's MVP. This is true, but that doesn't mean that's necessarily his strength, and it's not playing to his strength. And given that this is now year three of this calamity, of them doing this in the playoffs, I'm beginning to seriously question, is it Giannis demanding tyrannically, "I'm the best player, give me the ball or else," or is it Mike Budenholzer with the least imaginative offense in the history of basketball? either way, it cannot continue if Milwaukee has any designs on winning a championship or even getting out of this series.
Amin El-Hassan here on 95.7 The Game. At what point does the blame fall on Jrue Holiday for not running an offense? I mean, there's no reason for Giannis to be initiating plays. He needs to be finishing them. The point guard's got to be the initiator. I thought Jrue Holiday was supposed to solve this problem.
I thought so, too, and I thought he did for most of the regular season. And now we get to the playoffs, and we're seeing Giannis 23 feet from the basket with Blake Griffin guarding him. Approximately 7 feet from the basket. Blake Griffin's like, I don't care where you start from. You don't have to finish it somewhere around here because I don't trust or believe your abilities from out there. And this somehow still evades and eludes Milwaukee as a team. Yeah, we could put some of the blame on Jrue Holiday. He didn't have a particularly good game last night, and maybe he should be calling for it. But to me, as a team, we've got to have conversations on what to do. I mean, you didn't talk about this at all. Hey, guys, what do we do if someone drops off Giannis 20 feet? That don't happen. That was a one-time thing. That's so yesterday. What are you talking about? No, of course. They're going to do this every single game, every single series. So how do they not have any sort of counter for that? I was watching that game last night, guys, and I'm saying, somebody, Bryn Forbes, just run at him. Dribble handoff, and then tell Blake Griffin, okay, you're going to sit right back there? Cool. We're going to get a wide-open shot out here. The irony is at the other end of the floor, with about 90 seconds, Kevin Durant hit a three-pointer on the right wing, if you guys remember. He caught the ball. Bruce Brown sets a pick. He dribbles towards the center of the floor. P.J. Tucker gets picked off. He's behind Durant now, and Durant rises and fires clean look. And the reason why it's a clean look is because Brook Lopez, rather than come up and crowd that screen and blitz Durant on the other side of it, he sags back. Why is he sagging back, you might ask? Because this genius is worried about Bruce Brown, who's killed him all game long with those little floaters. So basically, Brook Lopez is in the same drop coverage that Blake Griffin is in on the other end. The difference is Brooklyn understands when their bigs are dropping, we're getting a shooter come off that screen and firing. And Milwaukee, everyone's sitting around and watching Giannis rather than have a shooter run off him and get a clean look. And to me, yes, we can blame Giannis, and I guess, yes, I could blame Jrue Holiday, and I could blame Bryn Forbes or Chris Middleton or any one of these other individuals. But to me, that is a major strategic flaw because this isn't the first time they've seen this defense, not this year, not last year, not the year before. And by the way, Brazil ran the same defense against Giannis in the World Cup.
There you go. I don't want us to get stuck on just one series. There's too much action happening in too many towns to just get stuck one place. Since the concept was don't know what to do with the ball in Milwaukee, let's go to Phoenix, where clearly there is nobody in the world of basketball who knows more of what exactly to do with the ball right now than Chris Paul. He has been such a difference maker, and as much respect as I got for what the Nuggets might be and might be still in the future with Jamal Murray, they just don't have a backcourt to match up with Paul and Book right now. This could be El Sweepo.
Yeah, and you know, I was on the radio, Salt Lake City radio, with Spencer Checkett, and he said something that I thought was interesting. He said the Jazz, their number one, like, strength is they play hard every possession. And as soon as he said it, I said that's the difference in the Nuggets-Sun series. Because the Nuggets are talented, even with Jamal Murray on the sideline, they got the MVP of the league, right? But they don't play hard every possession. They don't play balls to the wall every possession. And the Suns do. And that's what you're seeing through two games. They're just getting outworked and out-efforted out there. And they're playing too cool to school for school for some reason. And I think that's really jeopardizing their ability to stay competitive out there. And a lot of that credit, of course, goes to Chris Paul, who's brought that sense of urgency to the Suns this season.
Michael Malone basically called them out for that very thing after game two, saying they quit. Is that a coach's last sort of gambit to shame a team in the playoffs into playing harder? Or does he recognize that this is so much a part of Denver's DNA that it isn't going to matter, because it sure seems like when you drop that on the public rather than just your own team, it almost seems like you're out of other motivational tools.
Yeah, I, in general, I would agree with you, Ray, but this is not the first time that Michael Malone has done this in his tenure in Denver. He does this routinely. He'll call out his team for effort. And then the other thing that he goes to his grab bag for a lot is the opposite, is to say the media, we don't respect his team. And even if you look at that MVP shirt that they put out for Jokic, it's all these things like too slow, overweight, a flopper, which I love. That's not incorrect. He is a flopper. But, you know, it's got all these things. Mike Malone likes to go to that well a lot. Like, we're disrespected, and we're going to show them that you guys don't have enough respect for us. And then the other side of that coin is, we were lazy, and we didn't play hard. For most people, I would say that's a well you can't go back to too often. But he does, and it seems to work for him.
Amin El-Hassan, you're talking about a well. We know Kawhi Leonard has a near bottomless level of well of basketball talent. He has been a force of nature that has altered the course of NBA history. That's how good he is. So why is he taking one shot in the last 7 minutes? Can you please try to explain the Los Angeles Clippers to me?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, you talk about needing a point guard in that situation. Holy hell, I guess we know what's on Lawrence Frank's to-do list this summer. We just get somebody, anybody, because I guess Rondo doesn't have a pulse anymore. So can we get someone with a pulse who can run a team? That's part of it. The other part of it is, again, the Clippers are in the same boat as the Nuggets. They've got that too cool to school for school mentality. We'll get to it when we get to it. There were two possessions in the fourth quarter yesterday, and Jeff Van Gundy pointed it out. It's just lackadaisical. You can't play like that. First of all, Paul George, where do you get off to have the confidence to throw that behind the back pass? With the playoff reputation you have. The crowd is chanting playoff P to him. That's how far the mighty have fallen. The crowd is literally chanting his own nickname to him derisively, sarcastically, because everybody in the world knows the fraud. The fraud in terms of being a playoff performer. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you got Reggie Jackson, who's just kind of lazily dribbling the ball up and kind of just lost it up there. Yeah, it's not like this guy, this 7 foot dude with 7'9" wingspan, has just won his third Defensive Player of the Year award today or anything like that. What could possibly go wrong? And that's the infuriating thing about the Clippers, is that for as talented as they are, and they're really talented. And by the way, Serge Ibaka, done for the year. He's having back surgery. They just don't seem to have the sense of urgency. They didn't have it last year when they were up 3-1 and up double digits in Game 5 and blew that 3-1 lead. And in Game 7, Doc Rivers sitting there begging these guys to play harder. And they don't seem to have learned anything of a lesson this year. It took them 7 games to get through Dallas, and I'm going to take them a whole lot less to lose to Utah.
So what you're suggesting, if we encapsulate everything, is that the only losing team that's going to end up this round with its pants on is Atlanta.
I mean, I don't know if that's an accurate. I mean, they're going to try to keep their pants on. How about that?
Well, I mean, but when they lose, it won't be because they shame themselves.
Right, right. Yes, that's true. But when they lose, it'll be because they were overwhelmed, and that has some sort of shame as well. Because Joel Embiid, and the last I checked, he's questionable for tonight. So that obviously weighs heavy on the balance of this series. But they don't have any answers beyond the players who might have answers who don't. They don't even have bodies. They don't have enough people who are large enough to guard him. You know, outside of, Capella and John Collins and some lesser names beyond that. So what's going to happen if Embiid plays is they're just going to get overwhelmed and trucked over game after game. And I believe Trae Young is going to have a harder time as games go by because those Sixers have a lot of long defenders who are smart and experienced and can give him problems.
I just saw this stat on Trae Young. In 7 career playoff games, 202 points, 70 assists. He's the first player in NBA history with 200 points and 70 assists in his first 7 career playoff games. And I just think, he really represents that we are now watching a true passing of the torch. in terms of the generation that was and the generation that is coming. And maybe it took LeBron getting off the stage to breathe oxygen, you know, into some new guys to watch in their careers. But what we've seen out of Trae Young and Devin Booker and Devin Mitchell, we just lost in the last round Luka, Jason Tatum, and Ja Morant. I mean, we say this almost every year, but I think we really mean it this year. The amount of young, under 24-year-old talent in this league right now is just absolutely ridiculous, and we're not even including Zion because he didn't go to the postseason, and he might be the most talented and youngest of them all, for goodness sakes.
Yeah, and you know, not only that, but most of them appear to be the type of guys with not only the character but also the personality to be faces of the league, to be people that marketers will determine you will welcome them into your home to sell you appliances, to sell you soft drink, to sell you banking services, whatever it is. They all are really well put together. If I'm Adam Silver, I feel really good about the future of the league. The one question is, it feels like for at least the last 35, 40 years, we are a league of either one or two faces, right? It's not really, we haven't had a whole lot of seven guys representing the NBA.
Right.
It's Jordan. It's Magic and Bird. It's, Shaq. It's LeBron. It's Kobe. It's kind of like one or two guys at a time. And now we've got like a cast of guys, and I like them all, but I look at that and I say, which one of them has the opportunity and the potential to rise above it and say, no, I'm the guy, and everybody else is. Like the old movie goes, like, I'm David Ruffin, and these are the Temptations.
So who is that guy? If you could put next week's Meadowlark check and invest it in a future in an under 24-year-old NBA player, where would you put it? You have to put all of it, 100% behind one person. Who's the NBA young stock you buy?
Going against my better judgment about the xenophobic ways of American audiences and how they need someone who played AAU basketball in order to root for and believe in, I'm going Luka. I mean, he's got it all. He's got the kind of I don't want to call it sassiness, but like he's enough of a jerk that makes you kind of I kind of love him, right? And I think that's kind of, if you're too much of a nice guy, I don't know if there's a place for that at the throne. The throne.
Right.
This
was Harrison Barnes's problem. He was built to be a killer, but he was way too nice to be a killer.
Way too nice to be a killer. And Luka is the opposite, right? He's not built to be a killer, but he's an absolute assassin. And so that combined with, when you look at him, you're looking at a child genius. You're looking at someone who, as a teenager, was the MVP of the second toughest league in the world. And at every stage has been anointed, and at every stage has lived up to it. He's the closest thing to LeBron James we've seen since LeBron in terms of all the expectations. I'm here to shatter them all. And I'm going to rewrite all the record books. That to me, he's got everything going for him except for one thing. He's got a funny name, and he's from a funny sounding place. And will American audiences gravitate to a superstar who is not American?
Always a pleasure to talk basketball with you. We love it. Thank you very much. Best of luck to you and everyone fighting the good fight down at Meadowlark Media. I love sticking your chin out, going on your own way. So good luck with everything.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you so much. Amin El-Hassan. I love talking hoops with him, man. I really do. And
he chews on it a bit.
Yeah, he cares. He cares. And I think he cares more than the Clippers have so far, or the Nuggets have. And Mike Budenholzer has done a bad job. And he calls it like he sees it, and that's good. And I wish I could have. Could we bring him back to tell him that when the Clippers do get eliminated, I'm reserving Loy Vaught for the Patino game? Loy Vaught is not walking through that door. Who else you got an offering up in great Clippers history? That's about it. We dared to ask Ray, what might you want to talk about? Is there something that you wanted to bring up that we haven't been able to get to? What has been gnawing at you, poking at you? And Ray, here you go. We have 3 minutes before a commercial break comes up. What would you like to talk about for 3 minutes?
I don't know if this is gnawing at me, but this year was another reminder that the NBA playoffs and the Stanley Cup playoffs are different in one existential way. The NHL promises you chaos. The NBA can't give you anything close. Because even this year, when there are almost no teams with any kind of championship pedigree, you're still looking at 8 of the top 9 seeds who have advanced. And the teams that are likely to advance from those 8 teams are going to be the 1s and 2s. So the NBA is all about form, even when it's guys in different shirts. The NHL is going into its Final Four. It's not even a conference final anymore because they've had to change their format. The best team, the 5th best team, the 12th best team, and the 16th best team. And I don't know what's more refreshing. Well, no, I do know what's more refreshing. The Stanley Cup playoffs are, because everybody's got a weird shot. And if you like chaos, that's where you go. But I don't know if people would like if it weren't for the fact that the NBA is chalk all day, every day. And the only thing that happens with the NBA playoffs is that the teams that aren't the chalk and the players who aren't on the chalk teams always get beaten up for not going far enough, when in fact, we kind of knew how this was going to play out when the playoffs started. In fact, we kind of knew how it was going to play out at the start of April.
Why do you think talent can just carry an NBA team through, and in hockey, it's not even close to that?
Well, one, that the NBA, there's more scoring, and because there's more scoring, there's more of a premium on the talent that can score. Secondly, it's because the game itself is not necessarily reliant on one guy. One guy can be very helpful, but if you don't have 3 or 4 close to elite, sort of, not role players, that's diminishing it too much, but close to role players.
Make one of them your goalie.
Yeah, well, no, I'm talking about the NBA.
Oh, it's okay, just, yes.
Yeah, you need a decision-making guard. You need a power forward who will, you know, disrupt shots and get rebounds. I mean, those skills still need to happen. In the NHL, like, the Montreal Canadiens are the most absurd semifinalists in about 25 years because they don't have a real superstar or anything close to that, except for maybe Carey Price, the goalie, who 2 years ago was considered past it. And now they have a fighter's chance of getting to the Stanley Cup playoffs for the first time in 28 years. And I think it's just the different nature of the sports that makes the combination of them worthwhile. That a steady diet of the NBA, unless you're a complete basketball junkie, seems kind of incomplete if you don't have that sort of "what the hell did I just watch" of the Stanley Cup playoffs going right against it. They should always have to be together, no matter what anybody wants to do with the schedule, because the juxtaposition is too good.
I'll say this. The NBA can throw a game of "what the hell did I just watch" action at you, where hockey can throw a whole series of "what the hell did I just watch" at you. And that is a wonderful difference. You're right. You wouldn't want just symmetry everywhere, chalk talking all over the place. And there is no doubt there is an element of chaos in every Stanley Cup playoff game that makes it unique unto itself. And that's why playoff hockey is so different. That's why overtime playoff hockey is...
It is God's greatest gift to mankind.
It is. It's mainlining sports drugs is what it really is. It's good times. When we come on back, happy birthday to a Bay Area legend. Did you even know that an absolute god among us is celebrating a birthday today? We'll tell you who that is next as we come on back for our longest, commercially uninterrupted segment of the entire day, where we're going to replay a conversation with Alex Dickerson earlier today. A-plus appearance that you have to hear. So stay tuned. Speaking of having to hear it, you're going to have to hear a sound check before it's all said and done today. And we have one for you as we look back on the week that was. Oh, yes, we will rip off a good idea from the Jim Rome show. It only took us several years to do it. So we're going to do that before it's all said and done this afternoon. Damon Ratto and Kolsky on 95.7 The Game. We were brought to you by Fremont Bank. Full service banking. No compromises.
Damon Ratto and Kolsky continues on 95.7 The Game.
Good to have you here. Thanks so much for stopping on by. Happy birthday, Joe Montana. How about that? I heard he was a kind of a big deal around here at one point in time. Anyone else know that it's Joe Montana's friggin'? Is that just like a birthday? It's just like one of those, what is that, like 54, 63. It's not one of them off number. It's a big one. It's 65. 65 for Joe Montana, born June 11th, 1956. Still looks fantastic. Ray, we'd be so lucky to look that good at 65. He and his wife remain what I can only tell you is a handsome couple. You know what Joe Montana's middle name is? I did not know. I looked this up today.
Thelma.
No, but we knew Barry Lamar Bonds. This cool. is just as good.
Not Joe what, Cool.
It's not Joe Cool. No, it's not, Lucas. Good guess. Clifford. Freaking Clifford.
See, I think he would have been cooler as either J.C. Montana or Clifford Montana.
Well, Joe is not, you know, no one drops a that's a cool name on the name Joe. Clifford Montana? Cliffy, like to me, you must have a very important cliff or something in your life, because to me, all cliffs are measured directly against Cheers character, Cliff Clavin. Like, Cliff Clavin's not. Cliff is not a cool name in my book. Too cool for Joe, but.
Ooh, Cliff Floyd.
Yeah. I'm still Clavening. I'm Clavin.
See, I thought you were going to refer to Aaron Harang, who was celebrated for his birthday by the A's earlier this week, despite the fact that his birthday's in May.
How'd that happen?
I don't know, but the Phillies, for whom Aaron Harang also pitched, got a happy birthday shout out on the internet in May on his proper birthday.
Oh, well, that's nice. Happy birthday
twice
to Aaron Harang a couple of times, and to Joe Montana today, 65 years old. Kids, if you want to be, if you want to go down as a legend, win 4 Super Bowls, lose 0 Super Bowls en route to winning 2 MVPs as well. He was so special, Ray, but you go and you had, if you want to know the difference between what football was and what football is, open up Joe Montana's football reference page. Like, go and look at that man's stats. He has the kind of stats that are, by today's standards, unimpressive. Joe Montana never once threw for a 4,000-yard season. He never once threw for more than 31 touchdowns. Never in his career. It was a different game. It was a completely different mindset. It was coached different. It was officiated different. It was played different. There was a level of violence that was allowed that is implicitly different than the still very violent game that we're looking at now. But isn't that something else? Isn't that unbelievable? Joe Montana, never 4,000 yards, never more than 31 touchdowns. And anyone who watched him will go to bat telling you it's one of the three greatest of all time.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. That's why I hate looking at raw numbers to make judgments on people. It's because you can't compare even players from 10 years ago. The game has changed that much in the last 5. And the accumulation of raw numbers, even just sort of an average, you know, if somebody says, well, he's averaging 330 yards a game, that's nice, but does it get you any closer to winning? And that's the real, that's still the best measure. And this is not like we're talking about Trent Dilfer, who won a Super Bowl despite, you know, almost never throwing the ball. It's, you know, you can tell what a quarterback is without immediately racing the Pro Football Reference. I mean, it's a nice comparison point if you're in a fantasy league. But in terms of determining who the best quarterbacks of all time are, I mean, I don't know that you cite a lot of numbers when you talk about Tom Brady. I mean, maybe you do with Mahomes, but I think...
The number that gets cited, Ray, is the Super Bowl total. That's the number.
Okay, but that, yeah, to me, that's not a stat. That's a jewelry drawer. you know, if you want to use that, I'm all for it. But nobody says, boy, Tom Brady's the sort of guy who would absolutely, he'll go for 440 today. No, he won't. He'll just beat you. And I'm not anti-analytics and I'm not anti-stats, but at some point, you have to be able to recognize that the game is not the thing that it was even 5 years ago. So that the numbers that you compile are only useful when comparing them to other players right now. They don't put you higher up on the all-time list of anything because football today is pinball. 10 years ago, it wasn't. 20 years ago, they still played in mud. So, you know, you're absolutely right about Joe Montana. If you also look at John Elway's stats, you won't be blown away by today's numbers, by today's standards. But he mattered. I mean, I don't even know that you'll look at Brett Favre and think, boy, that's special, just because you'll fix it on the interception total, which I believe he has more of than anybody. But at some point, you have to go beyond the numbers and say, I know what I saw. And it's not about accumulating numbers. It's about, did you win? And were you important to winning? And people can figure that out, like I said, without a calculator.
A guy in the text line says, hey, guys, I'm 40 years old. I grew up in the East Bay. How big was Joe Montana in his heyday nationally? Well, let me tell you, as a guy who grew up in upstate New York when Joe Montana was winning Super Bowls, Joe Montana was as popular in the state of New York as Lawrence Taylor was. And you couldn't get more popular than a football player in the state of New York than Lawrence Taylor. Joe Montana was the beginning and end of just about every single quarterbacking conversation that was had in his era. I mean, he was a cut above them all, running an offense that scared the hell out of absolutely everybody that saw it, to the point where West Coast offense just became offense. And you could not find a more popular football player in the 80s than Joe Montana.
They were the automatic late afternoon game in the East, which is, that essentially is the compliment. It's CBS, which normally had 49er games, would put them on in the national slot rather than the Cowboys. And the Cowboys, even at that point, were still sort of America's team. I mean, basically, Cowboys played in the morning, 49ers played in the afternoon. And that was for an entire decade.
Who did more to change the 49ers' DNA? Bill Walsh or Joe Montana?
You can't
have one without the other. I know that.
What I was about to say was, if you put Joe Montana on a league average team, he's a slightly better than league average quarterback. If you give Bill Walsh league average talent, he's a slightly better than league average coach. With both of them and the other Hall of Famers and great players they had, they were essentially invincible for the start, the middle, and the end of the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, essentially invincible is not an underestimate of that team's talent at the time. I want to talk about DNA, because there are players that come into situations or leave situations and a team's DNA changes immediately, like implicitly right there. In basketball, it's probably easier to see than any other sport because one guy can make that much of a difference. And obviously, maybe basketball's singular all-time DNA leader is LeBron James. He is the modern book of winning DNA. He has done it in three different cities now, and the winning follows him wherever he goes. NBA Finals appearances happened to just pop up in whatever NBA city he lands in. But for this year, for the first time in a very, 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 very long time, in over a decade, he will not be involved in the NBA Finals. Nobody changes the DNA like LeBron all the way to a title. A lot of people would insist that unless a team went on to win a championship, their DNA has not been changed. And that's ridiculous. Who's done more to change a team's DNA than Chris Paul this year, right? Chris Paul, not only changing the DNA of the Suns being added to them, but you subtract him from Oklahoma City. Obviously, they have reprioritized who they want to be, and it's a full-on rebuild. But to subtract him from Oklahoma City is to change their DNA entirely as well. James Harden might not be participating right now. You take that guy out of Houston, Houston DNA changed forever. And I do think, even though everyone says it's Durant's team, look at Kevin Durant, everybody, James Harden did more to change the DNA, maybe of the Nets, than Kyrie Irving, or just based on availability and getting out there, than maybe even Durant has. Or you can say, well, Durant is now the magnet that everyone came to be around, so of course he changed the DNA more than anybody else. And I guess this is what's so infuriating about the Clippers as we look at them, because it's not like it doesn't seem like Kawhi Leonard wants to take another DNA test. Like, he is very happy with letting the Clipper DNA define him more than he redefining the DNA of the LA Clippers. And on that note, let me welcome everybody to your 5 o'clock hour.
Listen to every MLB game live.
In the deep left center field, it is high, it is far, it is gone.
Stream minor league affiliates.
The Midwest League home run leader.
And watch the best baseball highlights and look-ins on MLB Big Inning. MLB At Bat is your all-in-one live baseball subscription for only $3.99 per month.
Deep left field, it's going to go. Alvarez ties the game.
Subscribe to At Bat within the MLB app today. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.